can get the rule of the mob very easily. And I think when you lose transcendent belief, you tend to go into mob rule, really. The Planet Shakers and the Benedictines, they're inspired by the same gospel verses and the same Old Testament verses and so on. Really, they're the same. It was just an incredible privilege to talk to these four people at great length about their deepest beliefs.
Well, welcome to the Ask podcast. And Greg, good to see you. We're here in Pouring It Down, Sydney, and you're enjoying hot Melbourne. And amazingly, you're continuing, we're not going to talk about this, but you're continuing to write and, you know, help us understand the situation the world finds it in just now. So thank you for that. We are going to talk about politics, but we're going to talk about the faith of political leaders, not, you know, particular political viewpoints.
Absolutely. Well, it's great to be with you, David, and thanks so much. And it's a joy. I used to think it was a human right that I could have some time not thinking about Donald Trump. Now I think it's a human right that I can have some time not thinking about the tragedy going on in the Russian war in Ukraine.
In your chapter 9, Light and Shadow in the Hearts of Leaders, I'm intrigued by the quote at the beginning from Jacques Maritain. Not only does the democratic state of mind springs from the inspiration of the gospel, but it cannot exist without it. Justify that.
Well, Jacques Maritain, one of the great figures of 20th century sort of philosophy in the intersection between religious philosophy and civil philosophy, how you form a government, that sort of thing. He's very influential in the Declaration of Human Rights for the United Nations. And he lived and worked at a time when a lot of Europe still recognized its Christian inheritance. You know, I don't want to verbal him, but he really argued that Western democracy requires Christianity to function properly because it requires people to accept the universality of human dignity and human rights. It requires people to have a regard for their enemy, have a regard for their political opponent, to act in goodwill and with restraint. It requires them to delay the satisfaction of wants and desires, and it requires a concern for the common good, which sometimes transcends an individual's own good, at the same time as recognizing the inalienable human rights of the individual. So there's a certain tension. Society has rights and the individual has rights as well. And Maritain was one of a group of Christian activists and intellectuals who could see how Europe was going and thought it was full of trouble. And really, we've ended up where Maritain predicted we would be.
I mean, it's interesting because that great Scotsman, Adam Smith, I'm paraphrasing him a bit, but he basically argued that for economic systems, capitalism was the best of all systems, you know, and but without Christianity, it would be hell on earth. You know,
absolutely.
And I wonder if I would say the same about democracy, that, you know, that there's a perception that people have of democracy, if you're, say, from China, or dare I say it, even Russia, that democracy is the tyranny of the majority, which it would be if it wasn't for the human rights and the values, which I agree with you, I think come from the gospel.
You're absolutely right about Adam Smith, of course, The Wealth of Nations. He was a moral philosopher, and he wrote great works about moral philosophy as well as the operations of the market. And while he had a great understanding of the efficiency of the market, he thought the market had to operate within a moral framework, and he didn't think the market was the moral answer to all dilemmas. So some of the people who love Adam Smith tend to just focus on one part of his work. But I absolutely agree. Democracy can be simply the tyranny of the majority. One of the hardest things to understand about all truth is that all truth has to be in a dynamic balance with competing truths. And no one thing, so you can't say people have absolute human rights or unlimited human rights, nor can you say that society has an absolute right to determine how it goes and so on. These things have to be in balance. You know, you have some individuals who have quirky or silly views, and but they still deserve human rights. And mob tyranny, you can get the rule of the mob very easily. And I think when you lose transcendent belief, you tend to go into mob rule, really, which is democracy. Mob, what is democracy unconstrained by transcendent values? It's mob rule.
There's been a tendency, particularly in American Christianity, but also I have to say in the UK, and you can tell me about Australia, where people will say, well, if you're a Christian, you will vote this way. So, I mean, I had a friend who said, I became a Christian and a Republican in the same day, you know, because that's what he thought. But I know other people who say, well, if you're a Christian, you'll vote left wing. And I've always felt that this identification of Christianity with a particular political viewpoint is really wrong. So I'd like your thoughts on that as well.
So I do believe there are certain principles of Christianity which impact politics and which you cannot violate or transgress. Yeah. So you have to treat people with human dignity. You have to have a respect for your political opponents. These are kind of iron rules. And then there are some issues on which Christianity is very clear. Life issues. You cannot decide that someone is not worthy of life because they are old or frail or of a different race or handicapped or whatever. So there are certain sort of issues which strike at basic principles where Christianity is absolutely clear. But every politician I've ever interviewed who is a Christian acknowledges that the Bible is not a policy handbook, as Scott Morrison puts it. And it doesn't adjudicate, in my view, between centre-left and centre-right issues. In America, the right tends to say all the time, how can you be a Christian if you don't support gun rights or something? You know, and you see these grotesque posters of a cross and a gun next to each other, as though somehow or other being a Christian is associated with the constitutional right to bear arms in the United States. And then, as you say, there are, in Britain and Australia, miles and miles of Christians who say, unless you support our policy about open borders, you are not a good Christian, you are a racist. Mm-hmm. Or unless you support our welfare policies, you are not a good Christian. I saw a profile written once of Tony Abbott and Bill Shorten, and the writer said, they're both educated by Jesuits. Jesuits say you should live a life for others. Bill Shorten clearly does because he supports higher welfare. Tony Abbott clearly doesn't because he doesn't support higher welfare. And of course, this is just absolute nonsense. The principle is you should try to benefit others. Of course, absolutely. But an example I give in the book is Christians are always concerned for the poor. They're always concerned for the poor. Jesus' example about this is absolutely clear. It's all through the Gospels. It's all through the epistles. But the Bible doesn't tell you how to help the poor. So you might, as a politician, come to the view, I'm going to help the poor by extending welfare. That's a perfectly legitimate thing to argue. That's a left of centre solution. You might come to the view, I'm going to help the poor by deregulating the labour market so that more people get jobs in the formal sector of the economy. That gives them an income. It gives them the dignity of labour. It gives them purpose. Nothing helps a person achieve an integrated and fulfilled life that a state can do more than the provision of a job. And I've had this discussion with people in the third world, countless places, you know, in India, where if you're in the formal economy, you're infinitely better off than if you're in the informal economy, but the formal economy can't expand because the industrial regulations are too tight. Mm-hmm. So for a Christian to say, I'm going to increase welfare or I'm going to deregulate the labour market, they are both perfectly legitimate responses to the injunction to care for the poor. For either politician to say, if you don't support me, you're not a good Christian, is absolutely outrageous. And in the last book, one of the most thoughtful and brilliant, lovely people I interviewed was Kim Beazley, the former Labour leader. He's extremely reluctant to be interviewed about his religious belief because he said, you know, mate, my policies are not my religion. It's not a sin to disagree with me. I don't want to stand in the way of any man's experience of the cross. And I said, yeah, that's fine, Kim, but let's do the interview anyway. Because actually, David, the final thought on this, I in my books, I'm not interested really in the politicians' policies. I mean, in my day job as a secular journalist, I'm interested in their policies all the time. But in my book, I'm not inquiring into how their faith has impacted their politics. That's a 29th order issue for me in the book, and I barely touch on it. What I'm really just interested in is, what do they actually believe, and how does faith impact their lives? And as far as I know, I don't think people ever ask politicians this. I mean, lots of people ask Tony Blair, how did being a Christian affect him as Prime Minister? But I'm interested in, I remember reading Shirley Williams' autobiography, a lovely British politician, and she said at one point her first marriage broke down, she couldn't remarry because she was a Catholic and so on. And I thought, wow, that's interesting. So she was willing to submit to that rule of the church her whole life. So that means she must have really believed it. And I would love to hear what she really believed, instead of which she just noted this fact and went back to the political stuff. And I thought, gosh, Shirley, you're such an interesting, admirable person. Tell me more about what you actually believe. So what I try to get to with these politicians is, what do they believe? Do they pray? What impact does religion have on their lives? What impact does Jesus have on their lives? Not on their policies, so to speak.
One of the things that strikes me about Australia is how many politicians are religious. So you state here that when Scott Morrison became Prime Minister, that the top of his government was uniquely diverse religiously. Morrison is famously a Pentecostal. His deputy prime minister, leader of the National Party, Michael McCormack, was Catholic. And his treasurer and deputy leader of the Liberal Party, Josh Frydenberg, was Jewish, the first Jewish politician to hold that position. I mean, that's fascinating. You also said that you can explain who the four are. There are four national leaders who have served at the highest levels, one Liberal, one National, one Labour, and one with no party affiliation. So who are they?
So one was Scott Morrison, because obviously, you know, he's the Prime Minister, and I honestly believe his Pentecostal, his Christian faith is at the centre of his life. His faith and his family are the absolute centre of his life. I'm no doubt about that. One was John Anderson, National Party leader, wonderful man, Deputy Prime Minister for many years under John Howard, profoundly religious man, and really, really a wonderful man. Another was Bill Hayden, former leader of the Labour Party, Foreign Minister, Governor General. Fascinating guy, because for many decades he was an out-and-out atheist, and he won the Humanist of the Year, and he used to make an intellectual case against God. But in the end, he couldn't bear the despair of atheism, and he had an encounter with a very holy woman, and he just felt the reality of her holiness, and he came back to God. A very moving fellow. And then the fourth was Peter Cosgrove, former Governor General, former Chief of the Defence Force, former Head of the Army, who led the intervention in East Timor. But I was particularly interested, he was a platoon commander in Vietnam, and he saw a lot of action. He was involved in killing people, and he saw his comrades killed. And I was very interested to talk to him about faith in war. What's it like to be a believing Christian and to be killing the enemy and to be seeing your comrades killed? And it's fascinating. All the millions of interviews he's done, and Cos is a great bloke, you know, Cos is the best friend you could ever have, and you'd want him next to you in a foxhole. Nobody had ever asked him that. And I thought, isn't that strange? You know, and yet Cos was a notable Christian, you know, a notable Catholic. Everyone knows that about Cos, but no one had ever asked him that particular question about belief, you know, in battle.
I found that, you know, that whole section fascinating, and I do want to encourage people to go and read the book and the Hayden one as well. John Anderson, whom I know, you're right. You did make me laugh with the Jermaine Greer comment.
That's right. He says he's the only cabinet minister she'd like to bed.
Oh, dear. I mean, I know that people look and they say, you know, he comes like, oh, it must be artificial, it must be artificial. There's not an ounce of artificiality in him. He's a genuine gentleman, isn't he? And I find his podcast series absolutely fascinating, the highest quality, you know.
He is, you know, in that series, Doc Martin, Louisa says to Doc Martin at one point, she's working out why she loves him. He's such a bloody, you know, curmudgeonly difficult person. And she says, you know, you are like a stick of Brighton rock. You're the same all the way through. Every mm-hmm. part of you is the same. And that is, if I can use this sort of very clumsy analogy, that is John mm-hmm. Anderson. There's mm-hmm. not, I don't think there's one speck of artifice about John. Mm-hmm. You know, he's shaped a bit by his background and everything. He's very brave. He's had tremendous misfortune in his life. In fact, both John Anderson and Bill Hayden really dealt with terrible tragedies in their lives. And his Christian faith has strengthened from year to year, from decade to decade. And I think it's insane that the National Party rejected. I mean, here I am making a political comment, and I said I never would. It's insane the National Party rejected his generous offer to come back to politics. And we certainly need people of that quality. But I'd say that of all four of these guys, ScoMo, Coz, Hayden and John Anderson, all four of them. You could stake your life on the integrity of all four of them, I think.
And that's a wonderful thing, you know, because, you know, sometimes I look at Australian politics and it depresses me as much as UK or American politics, in that there does seem to be a particular form of viciousness, you know. I mean, I saw a cartoon today, which lots of banners with you know, ScoMo responsible for the flood and ScoMo this and ScoMo that. And I just thought, okay, disagree about politics, but the level of personal vitriol is quite disturbing. And then I look and I do see, I mean, you can tend to be very cynical about all politicians, which we have the luxury of doing because we're not making the decisions and we can snipe from the sidelines, or at least I can say that. But I do see people like John Anderson and Scott Morrison, and, you know, there are other people on the left as well. And I'm thankful to God, to be honest, that they're there, that they are, first of all, people of integrity. And I think that is so important. And you bring that out in the book. How well do you know Scott Morrison?
Look, moderately well. Mm-hmm. So there's a generation of politicians, Tony Abbott, Malcolm Turnbull, Bob Carr, Kevin Rudd, who I knew really, really well, long before mm-hmm. they went into politics, and in Tony Abbott's case, long before I went into journalism. Mm-hmm. So I don't know Scott Morrison as well as that. I met him as a journalist meets a professional politician. Mm-hmm. But, you know, journalists swim in a sea of politicians. Probably no group of people understands politicians better than journalists do, and probably no mm-hmm. group of people understands journalists better than politicians do. We live in a very close symbiotic relationship. And, it, you know, it has its degree of hostility. I've been giving ScoMo a hard time lately on defence policy. Of course, here's the other thing. Being a friend makes no difference to, you don't get any exemption from getting a kicking if you do something wrong. Not a personal mm-hmm. kicking, mm-hmm. policy kicking. But I've known Morrison, I guess, for, I don't know, 15 years or 20 years or something. And I collaborated with him a great deal when he was immigration spokesman in opposition. We've talked quite a bit about religious matters over the years, just privately. And then I knew him all the way through, you know, the Abbott government and all subsequently. He's, mm-hmm. I think, he's a very open, straightforward guy. Like all politicians, he's got his good and his bad points. But I think he handles the public dimension of his Christian faith very well. And in our discussion for this book, there was nothing that was off limits. There was no questions he didn't answer. So I wanted to ask him about the particularities of Pentecostalism, you know, speaking in tongues and mm-hmm. faith healing and all the rest of it. And he didn't run away from any of those issues. So I'm not his best friend, nothing like that. I wouldn't claim to have an intimate acquaintance with him. But I guess I've had hundreds of conversations with him over the years. And you do, you know, politicians and journalists also have quite an intense relationship. Politicians are sometimes very unhappy with the things that we say and do. And also all human beings, I shouldn't even say this in a podcast, but all human beings have a desire to confess, and even often to the most inappropriate person. And that's why it's so good to have a meal with a politician, see them at night, you know, spend a long time mm-hmm. with them, because people do tell you more face to face than they do over a phone conversation. And then we have the enormous responsibility of how to use that information properly. At the same time, politicians are very good at manipulating us. They know what our incentives and disincentives are.
But there are things, aren't there, that are, you know, you'd have a personal conversation with someone on the understanding this was not going to appear in one of your columns, and you, of course, would honor that. I think, incidentally, you mentioned about journalists knowing politicians and politicians knowing journalists. I should point out that clergymen, especially those who are wannabe journalists and wannabe politicians, we can bridge the gap for you as well.
Quite
You can
right.
confess. I'm not a Catholic priest, but you can confess to me anytime. You know.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right about off-the-record conversations.
Yeah.
Because I've been writing about religion a bit here and there for 40 years, you know, only in a concentrated way for the last 5 or 6 years, but I would often have a column or so about some aspect of religious belief or whatever. And as a result, quite a lot of politicians over the years have talked to me in a private moment about religious issues. Now, they haven't confided in me their personal problem, nothing like that. And I think I wasted those conversations because I was too cagey. I was too much a journalist. I didn't want to give anything away and so on. But most religious believers, when they meet another religious believer, they're interested to talk, to share a moment of solidarity. And a lot of politicians, even who are atheists, are very questioning about it. You know, they think about it. They're uneasy. They're suffering a crisis of disbelief. Certainly, Bill Hayden was someone with whom I had a number of conversations about belief over the years when he was an atheist. And as I say, I think I tended to run away from those conversations a bit. I didn't deny anything, but I was a bit too sort of too cagey. I wasn't open enough myself. I had too many defense mechanisms up myself. With ScoMo, it was a bit easier because I was older by the time I got to know him. And also, he is just so straightforward about his own faith. So sometimes I'd write a column about faith and he'd text me a correction. He'd say, you know, good effort, Greg, but by the way, you made a mistake about X, Y, Z and so on. Well, that invites you into a dialogue. And basically, all your conversations with them are private unless you agree that something is on the record. So if a politician rings you up and talks to you, you're not gonna treat that as an on-the-record interview that you can print the quotes and so on. Or if you do, that's not good practice, you know.
No, and they won't trust you if you do. I mean, there's a couple of politicians back in Scotland that I've said to them, do you know, if I ever went public about our faith conversations, your career would be finished. But you know, I
Absolutely.
mean, you develop a relationship of trust in that regard. I'm sure that's the case. I was fascinated by the Pentecostalism side of it because even, you know, Christians, you know, Catholics, Calvinists, evangelicals, the idea of Pentecostalism, it still carries an image of a little bit weird, and they take the extreme sort of televangelists and that kind of thing. And you know, the notion of Australia having a Pentecostal prime minister, it still raises eyebrows with some people, but you're not talking here about Scott Morrison, you know, the health and wealth teaching or, you know, the extreme right wing stuff or anything like that. So I was intrigued by your enthusiasm for Pentecostals.
Yeah, well, I myself, so no secret, as we've often disclosed, I'm a Catholic Christian myself. But as a young man, I did go to some prayer meetings because I had some friends who were involved in the charismatic movement within the Catholic Church. So, and I found those very interesting. I didn't find them fraudulent or charlatan or anything like that. You know, they were speaking in tongues and so on. And I think if you were not hostile, but still were a little bit agnostic about it, I would think it's just a kind of a uniformed vocalization of prayer without words. And it's a bit like, I guess, you know, singing a Latin hymn. You might not know what the words mean, but you know it's holy and you know it's directed at God. So it never struck me as inherently as weird as it possibly strikes people, you know, at first blush, or who've only seen the caricatured version in America. And then for the last book, God Is Good For You, I had a really deep encounter with the wonderful Pentecostal church in Melbourne, the Planet Shakers, and I just thought they were fantastic. And it struck me because I went to see a Benedictine monastery not long after I'd been to the Planet Shakers, or maybe the order was the other way around. And what struck me was that the Planet Shakers' worship was essentially around biblical passages, and so was the Benedictine worship. And it just so happened that on the day I visited the Benedictines and the day I visited the Planet Shakers, they were using the same Bible passages. Now, you know, as we've discussed, David, my effort in the book is to take a C.S. Lewis mere Christianity view, where I'm happy with any Christian who can, you know, sign up to the Apostles' Creed. And I thought, well, really, the Planet Shakers and the Benedictines, they're inspired by the same gospel verses and the same Old Testament verses and so on. Really, they're the same. You know, it's just a slightly different style of music and, a radically different style of music, I suppose. But I think the Pentecostals, like everybody, they have their problems. You know, every Christian denomination has had its share of bad folks as well as overwhelmingly good folks. But I think they are mainstream, pretty orthodox Christians. All Christians believe in praying for the sick. But the Pentecostals tend to be very confident about their ability to gain God's intervention. But I think, you know, as I comment again and again in the book, Christianity is very diverse. You know, if the Pentecostals have a slightly different way of worshipping from me, that's fine. I don't think there's anything inauthentic about that. And you look at their works, they give to charity enormously, and they're very effective. They're terrific at recruiting people. People find meaning and joy there. And I've no doubt at all. So ScoMo may be a bad prime minister or a good prime minister. I make no argument about that in this book. But I have absolutely no doubt at all that he is a sincere, believing, profound Christian. And I also believe his Christian beliefs as a Pentecostal are entirely mainstream Christian beliefs.
Yeah, and I think, you know, one of the most nauseating things you see is when people will profess a belief for political reasons. There's absolutely nothing to be gained in Australia by saying you're a Pentecostal, you know. At least not in the circles that most politicians move. There will be in some areas, but so I mean that genuineness really, really stands out. And you know, I don't know Hayden, but I do know Anderson, and I think that genuineness, that authenticity, also, you know, stands out. And again, it's very important for people to understand that Anderson and ScoMo and people on the left as well who are Christians are not saying, we've got the Bible, it's a policy book for us. They're saying, we are Christians, this is what we believe. And in a sense, everyone's philosophy and ethos will affect their politics, so we can't deny that. But they are not claiming God has told us that we've to put income tax at this level, or that we've to deal with Ukraine in this way, or, you know, and or deal with climate change in whatever. And I think that you bring that across in the book very well. Listen, our time has gone. Is there anything else you want to add on this particular chapter?
Well, let me offer two final notes, and I'll try to be brief, David, but you can edit me if I'm too long-winded.
No, you just go, be as long-winded as you want. Listen, nothing will change. Carry on.
I also thought Cosgrove was tremendously moving in saying that in battle, he recognised the human dignity of the men that he killed. So he believed in just war. He believed in the profession of arms. He believed in being a soldier. He was doing as his country asked him to do, and he was doing what was required. But he had no sense at all of privileging a Christian over a non-Christian. And when he saw the bodies of the enemy dead, he recognized that they were human beings. They were made in the image and likeness of God. They had families. They had immortal destinies. And he felt compassion for them. And he prayed constantly in battle. Now, Cos is one of the most successful and brilliant and ebullient soldiers Australia has ever produced. And I thought, although his manner is tremendously bluff and friendly, and it's not self-indulgent or intellectual, I thought there's something quite profound in what Cos is saying there. And I'd love more Christian soldiers to speak about this. And I think the reason they don't is modesty. It's not shame and it's not hubris or anything. It's just modesty. The other reflection I'd like to offer, David, it's a long time since Bill Hayden retired from public life. And as I say, unlike Cosgrove, ScoMo and John Anderson, Hayden, for most of his public life, was a believing atheist, a professed atheist. But I always found Hayden a tremendously decent man. And I always thought that there was a sense of the tragic in Bill. And I didn't realize until I spoke to him for this interview how much that was. So as a kid, he had a father who used to abuse his mother, and he'd see his father knock his mother out. And as a little boy, he'd say to himself, I want to grow up and be a policeman so I can stop men like that. I want to stop men like that. And then as a young married man, his five-year-old daughter was run down and killed. And he told me he was insane with grief. He was deranged with grief. And he says he never really recovered from it. It affected his whole life, and he thinks that's true of his whole family. Told me of dreams that he'd have of meeting his, that it had all been a mistake. And decades later, he'd meet his daughter grown up in a shopping center, and she'd had a happy life herself. And this dream is a kind of, it's a blessing, but it's also a torture, because then you wake from the dream and you find it's not true. But then later in life, so Bill had always been thinking about these things, always grappling with these issues. And later in life, he went to visit a nun whom he'd known very well, who'd had a heart attack and was in hospital. And he was just overwhelmed with the sense of her holiness. And she's a very great woman in her own right, deserves a thorough biography. He was also tremendously influenced by his wife, who has always been a religious believer. And then he was influenced by the sheer terrible emptiness of atheism. And so he came back to God. And with all his strength, he prays every day. He prays for people who would have been considered his enemies. And he tries to help the church in every way that he can. He tries to help the poor. He tries to help St. Vincent de Paul. And there's just a sheer honesty about Bill Hayden. And I think an elemental decency. And it's a long time ago. You'd have to be an Australian of a certain age, really, to remember Bill Hayden. But I think if ever there's a sense of integrity and a lifelong journey back to God, it's there in Bill Hayden. So my final reflection is, of all the chapters, this, well, like the last chapter with the Christians who continue to give, it was just an incredible privilege to be able to talk to these four people at great length about their deepest beliefs, and have them open their veins, really, to share. You know, Cos could have fobbed me off with simple phrases about, you know, you're too busy in battle to look at war. And Bill Hayden could have effortlessly just declined the interview. There was no, you know, Bill's a very, very ill man now, and there's nothing, no sort of upside. There's no particular benefit for him in doing this interview for the book with me. So I think it's a great privilege that those four blokes opened themselves in this way. And I'm astonished, as with these books altogether, I'm astonished people don't make these inquiries more often. I mean, you know, but there it is. That's so that's a very long-winded final reflection, David. But you asked for it.
No, I did ask for it, and I deserved it. And I'm almost dreading to say this. I think I'm going to book in an extra double session for our next one in a fortnight's time, because we're going to move on to China. And my first interest actually in you was because of your Chinese connections. And yeah, again, I found that section of the book absolutely fascinating. So, but Greg, once again, thank you very, very much. And we'll catch up with you in a fortnight.
Thanks a lot, David. Great to talk to you. Thanks so much.